Welcome to Grace Community Church On Demand, the weekly podcast from the Sunday services at Grace Community Church in Rupert, Idaho. Here at Grace, we believe in building the kingdom of God one person at a time. We're passionate about loving God, loving people, and following Jesus. Let's get into this week's message with Pastor Travis Turner.
How are we doing? Are we live? Nice to see that some of us got our clocks changed this morning. Still say that was the silliest thing anyone came up with. I mean, it sort of made sense maybe 100 years ago. So it'll be interesting to see who wanders in halfway through the service. So, how's everyone enjoying second winter so far? Or is it third winter? I've kind of lost count this year. But, you know, it's Idaho. It's part of the Welcome to Idaho package. Some people enjoy it. Some people don't. Maybe it's not for you. I don't know. You can decide that. The great thing, though, is it seems like we're finally getting more snow up in the Tetons, which is important for our water supply, as you guys know. How many farmers or people connected to agriculture do we have in the house? I mean, we all eat, so that's pretty much all of us. It's really funny, these people nowadays that are so disconnected from the earth that they have no idea where their food comes from. And it just, anyway, I could go on for hours about that. The other thing that's really fun this year is Pomerel, our fancy ski hill, is in the top 10 in the nation in terms of total snowfall. Not top 10%, but top 10. So all those losers that are skiing in other places like Sun Valley and Bogus Basin, and, you know, which is kind of funny. I recently, you know, everyone knows that Sun Valley makes all their snow, right? They have no snow. It's why they picked that spot to put a ski hill, I have no idea. But I was thinking Bogus Basin, maybe that's called that because they make their own snow too. Well, no. How many people know where Bogus Basin got its name? So back in the late 19th century, there was, you know, gold and silver rush in the Boise area. And there were some guys in that area that were trying to sell, it was pyrites or something, fool's gold as real gold. And they got in trouble and things happened. And as a result, the area became known as Bogus Basin because they were selling bogus gold. Sounds like a great place to put a ski hill. Yes, Travis was supposed to speak today, but he went to the DR and he came back with a really bad cold. So Pastor Frog is not here this morning. I'm beginning to think, and Tina actually agrees with me on this, I'm beginning to think we need to start curtailing his travel a little more carefully. I mean, how many people have had those kids that you can't take anywhere? Yeah, I feel like we have a pastor that you can't send anywhere. You know, he fell out at Jacob's graduation from Army boot camp. He nearly died of malaria going to Uganda. Now he goes to the DR and is flat of his back with a bad cold. I've got off the phone and told my wife, and she's like, is he going to like start carrying bug spray or something? I'm like, I don't think he's got malaria this time. I think he's okay. But the scary part is that between Javi, Travis, and I, he's the youngest one. And he's the one that's always getting sick and doing stuff, you know. I'm not going to say that I'm the oldest, but they're not as old as me. Ultimately, God's still on the throne. He's not surprised by any of this. It's all good. I have to say that, you know, one of the coolest things in my life right now is the fact that I am the guy that sometimes gets called to back up a Marine. That seems significant to me. So this morning, we're going to be in the book of Daniel. We've heard about the book of Daniel before. Travis did his really great series, his little 10,000-foot overview of the Bible. And he talked about Daniel. Daniel's kind of unique in the Bible. We've got books of prophecy in the Bible, a number of them in the Old Testament, one of them in the New Testament. And we've got books of history in the Bible, several of them in the Old Testament, several of them in the New Testament. But Daniel is unique in that it is both a book of history and a book of prophecy. The first part of the book tells the story of the early days of the Babylonian captivity when Nebuchadnezzar came and hauled off the Israelites. to Babylon, modern-day Iraq, and then the Persian Empire came through and took over. That would be modern-day Iraq, and then eventually the Greek Empire came in and took over through Alexander the Great and others. So we see this in the historical sections in the first part of the book, and then the second part of the book is prophecy, where many of these figures like Alexander the Great come to play. And so it's a fascinating book. It's one of my wife's favorite books. She's the prophecy nerd in the family. I just kind of pretend to know stuff about prophecy and ride her coattails and look smart. But today we're going to be in Daniel 11:32, and specifically the second half of that verse. And we're going to be talking about people who know their God. And so this verse says, and this is from the New American Standard and from the 1977 version, says the people who know their God will display strength and take action. The New English Translation, which is one of my favorite new translations, says it this way. It says the people who are loyal to their God will act valiantly. Aside from the fact that it sounds cool to talk about acting valiantly, which it should, it's interesting that they chose to say it that way, people loyal to their God. And you dig into the notes in the New English Translation, which is one of the things I like about it, and they explain the reason they translated it that way is because what's being described there is not just head knowledge and not even heart knowledge, but a deep, abiding knowledge of having been with someone. And so we all have head knowledge of people. I have head knowledge of all kinds of people that I don't personally know. And I have heart knowledge of people that I've spent time with and am friends with. But then there are those people that you'll actually take a phone call from at 3 o'clock in the morning. And a lot of people have head knowledge about God. They know who he is, they know who Jesus is, and they go to church and they sing songs. And there are people that have heart knowledge about God. They've prayed to receive Christ and this, that, and the other. But then there are those people that you hang out with and you realize that there's something different about their life. That when they talk about God, they're not just talking about some dude that they heard about in Sunday school, but they're talking about someone that they spend time with and know, and that the course of their life has been altered by this relationship with God. And that's what the New English Translation is trying to highlight there. People that are loyal to their God will act valiantly. How many people have known someone like that? That you sit with them and you chat with them and it just becomes evident that they have been with God and that that's the course of their life. So Daniel chapter 11 is talking specifically, it's a prophetic section. Daniel reports that he's given this vision from the angel Gabriel, that Daniel had prayed was praying in his room, confessing his sins, confessing the sins of his people, and praying for intercession in the midst of the mess they were in. And the angel Gabriel shows up, and you know, Daniel had been praying and fasting for 3 weeks. And Gabriel says, I came to you as soon as you started praying, but I was held up by the prince of Persia. He didn't mean some dude with a fancy hat. But Michael, who's your guardian prince, showed up, bailed me out, and now I'm coming to give you this message, and then I'm going to go help him. So here, Gabriel comes and gives Daniel this prophetic message, and he talks about the succession of kings and kingdoms that are going to be fighting over this area in the coming years. And when you read through this, and then you get the historical record and you compare things that are going on, all of a sudden, it's more like you're reading history than you're reading prophecy. Because all of a sudden, there are these very recognizable figures that emerge. You know, it talks about this strong king that's going to come in and take over and exercise his will. And when you look at the timing and the historical record, it's Alexander the Great. He took over the area around 323 BC. And then he died, and his kingdom was parted out into four of his generals. And two of them were Ptolemy and Seleucid. Ptolemy took over the region of Egypt. Seleucid took over the region north of there, which included Palestine and Judea. And then successive generations of rulers came a guy by the name of Antiochus the First. And Antiochus the First wanted to have a treaty with the Ptolemaic Empire of Egypt. And so he offered his daughter in marriage to the ruler of the Egyptian Empire. And his daughter's name was Cleopatra. Cleopatra's in the Bible. She's not named, but when you look at what's going on, it's evident that's who that is. And eventually, Daniel speaks of this notion of an abomination that leads to desecration. And history tells us that in 168 BC, Antiochus the Fourth, also known as Antiochus Epiphanes, had gone down, tried to take Egypt. The Ptolemies said, I don't think so. And he was ignominiously defeated. He was trounced. But they were nice. They let him go home instead of completely wiping him out. Coming home in defeat and indignation, he decides to pick on somebody else. And so he attacks Jerusalem. He sacks the temple. He sacrifices a pig on the holy altar. He erects an altar to Zeus in the holy sanctuary and does all kinds of unspeakable things to the Jewish people. And then comes this statement in Daniel 11:32. The people who know their God will display strength and take action. Those people who are loyal to their God will act valiantly. Mattathias Maccabee and his son Judah the Hammer. You guys have heard me talk about this, coolest Bible name ever, rose up in what history is called the Maccabean Uprising, and they fought with them. They eventually retook the temple, re-cleansed the temple, led to the festival of Hanukkah, which we've talked about. But as interesting as this is, there's a principle here that goes beyond what the Maccabees did. A people who know their God will display strength and take action. People who are loyal to their God will act valiantly. Throughout Scripture, we see people who knew their God and acted valiantly. Abraham offered Isaac as a sacrifice on Mount Moriah. Joseph was sold into slavery by his brothers to foreign rulers and yet maintained faith in God and literally saved the known world. Moses overcame his personal limitations and fears and faced down Pharaoh and led the people of Israel out of Egypt and helped establish them as a nation. David, as a callowed youth, faced down a giant and killed Goliath. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused to bow down to the golden statue that Nebuchadnezzar had erected and were saved from the fiery furnace. Daniel refused to stop praying and was saved in the lion's den. Esther risked her life to challenge Haman and save the nation of Israel from genocide. The Maccabees challenged the might of Greece and reclaimed and cleansed the temple. The common thread in all of these people is that when faced with an amazing task or challenge, either from God himself, in the case of Abraham and Moses, or from the enemies of God, they allowed their faith in God and their understanding of who he is to propel them into action. And while these stories from the Bible are important and amazing, they can also seem distant and disconnected from us today. After all, we aren't being asked to sacrifice our sons. We're not being asked to bow down to foreign gods or face the annihilation of our people. Politics aside for a moment. So are there people in our culture today that we can point to who have known their God and acted valiantly? That's what we're going to do, is we're going to spend some time talking about some people that may be familiar to you who have known their God and have acted valiantly. So let's start in. Billy Graham was born in a downstairs bedroom of a small farmhouse near Charlotte, North Carolina, on November 7th, 1918. The oldest of four children, he was raised on a dairy farm. Does anyone relate to this? Maybe a little. I've often commented that I could have dairy Thursdays and be busy every week. He developed a love for reading early in life and read many novels for boys, but especially He especially liked Tarzan. And friends reported that he would regularly climb trees and give a Tarzan yell. And his father said his Tarzan yelling eventually led to him becoming a minister. Somehow, I cannot see him on stage with George Beverly Shea giving a Tarzan yell. Becoming a Christian at age 16 during a series of tent revival meetings, which seems appropriate, he eventually attended Wheaton College in Illinois. While in college, he was invited to preach at a local church and eventually became their pastor. This led to an opportunity to preach on the radio, and eventually he began traveling and preaching in evangelistic meetings. In 1948, he wrote what was known as the Modesto Manifesto. He was in a hotel room in Modesto, California, and he had just noticed that even in that early time, there were Christian leaders that were being plagued with scandals and problems and whatnot. And so he wrote this manifesto, this code of ethics for life and work that was designed to protect against financial, sexual, and power abuse. Things like, you know, he pledged that he would never be found alone in public or private with a woman not his wife or related to him in some way. All these other kinds of things. This eventually became known as the Billy Graham Rule and would be adopted by many leaders, including heads of state. Some people recall several years ago Vice President Mike Pence being excoriated in the media for publicly holding this and choosing to act this way. And yet, we didn't see any sort of sexual scandals coming out of that White House. Maybe there's something to that. The first Billy Graham Crusade was held in September of 1947 in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and it was attended by 6,000 people. It's kind of interesting what it would have been like to be at that first Billy Graham Crusade. Nowadays, you mention the word Billy Graham and people will come for miles, but back then he was still nobody. So what did it take to get 6,000 people to show up at Grand Rapids for this first crusade? Over the course of the year, over the course of his career, he would hold over 400 evangelistic crusades around the world, the last one being in 2005. When I first was doing this, I'm like, well, that doesn't seem like a lot. But then I'm like, wait a minute. From the late 40s to the early 2000s, that's over 50 years, which means he was doing, you know, almost 10 of these a year. That seems like a lot, if you think about it, because these are big things. These were not like, you know, going to Grace Church and delivering a sermon. This was going around the world, having a big venue, lots of people running the event, and then you've got to invite tens of thousands of people in some of those arenas. Billy Graham was active in the civil rights movement. I had no idea. He was a close friend, supporter, and advisor of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He was also a friend of Nelson Mandela and was an ardent opponent of apartheid in South Africa. In fact, he was invited to come to South Africa to deliver one of his crusades, and when he insisted that they allow him to integrate the crowd, let blacks and whites sit together, they refused, and so he declined the invitation. And it wasn't until they allowed him to do that he came. In fact, he was one of the first evangelistic Christian pastors in America that insisted on integrating his crowds at meetings, even going so far in certain areas when they would put up ropes to separate blacks from whites, that he would personally go and tear down the ropes and make sure everyone knows this is not going to happen at his meeting. Dr. Graham was a friend of multiple presidents, being particularly close to Dwight D. Eisenhower, Lyndon B. Johnson, and Richard Nixon, and served as spiritual advisor to many others. His lifetime audience is estimated in the billions, with a B, and through his crusades, he personally preached to more people than anyone in the history of Christianity. He was on Gallup's list of most admired men and women a record 61 times. That's pretty much every year of his public ministry. He's considered among the most influential Christian leaders in the 20th century. His legacy lives on in the work of his family through the continued work of the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association, which is mostly being headed by his grandson, Will, and then also Samaritan's Purse and Operation Christmas Child, which we know something about here, which is headed by his son, Franklin. So here's this one guy that was literally born in a farmhouse in North Carolina. And yet, God captured his heart, and he went out to literally affect billions upon billions of people, work that continues long after his death. So who else can we talk about? A name possibly less well-known to some here, but maybe not others. Bill Bright was born on a cattle ranch in Coweta, Oklahoma, on October 19th, 1921. Yes, I know where Coweta is. I haven't been through there, but I could get there if I had to. Some of you will recall that I was born in Oklahoma. He attended college at Northeastern State University in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. The truly cultured and sophisticated in the group will recall that the story where the red fern grows took place in Tahlequah. And those that are cut above the rest will recall that the author was living in Idaho when he wrote the book. I do think that's cool as someone who is from Oklahoma but lives in Idaho. In his early 20s, Dr. Bright moved to Los Angeles, California, and started a company called Bright's California Confections. That's right, Bill Bright was a candy man. In 1946, he quit his candy business and entered seminary, studying at both Princeton and Fuller Theological Seminaries. In 1948, he married his wife, Vonette, who became his partner in life and ministry. Interestingly enough, he was from Oklahoma. Vonette was from Texas. Notice how I said that. She was from Texas. To add some scale to that, that's even worse than being from Declo. In 1951, Bill and Vonette sat in their small home and wrote and signed their contract with God, which remains a huge part of Campus Crusade lore, where they pledged their lives together to the service of God alone, to be slaves to his will, laying aside any ambitions they may have had at that point to follow God wherever he might lead. Vonette was the one of the two that liked to tell funny stories from their life. Bill was too serious for stuff like that, being a proper redneck from a small town in Oklahoma. And she talks about when they decided to do this, because Bill was a businessman. He's like, you know, I've written contracts with all kinds of different people. We've decided to pledge our life to God, so let's write a contract to God. And so they went into separate rooms. He went into their main bedroom, and she went into her bedroom, the spare bedroom. They weren't in separate bedrooms. Went into the spare bedroom. And they just sat there for an hour or so and just kind of, you know, what would they like to do for God, and what would they like to see that turn out? And Vonette tells the story on herself humorously that, you know, she wanted, you know, between two and four kids, and she wanted a couple of cars, but her car could be a Ford because those were the least expensive cars back then. And, you know, they wanted to, you know, have a modest enough home that if they were working with some indigent people off the street, as they often were in those days, that they would feel comfortable there, but nice enough that they could entertain important people, like even the president, maybe, even though that was not even on their horizon. And, you know, she kind of went on like this with different kinds of things. And then she presents that to him, and he doesn't say anything. He just kind of smiles and nods, and then he presents his list, and he talks about being a slave of God and having no desire for worldly wealth or fame or renown. He just wants to do whatever God wants to do. And, of course, she feels about this small. But then she jokes that later in life, the only reason they had things is because she's the one that prayed and asked for them. And, you know. But that was what they did, as they sat down and they wrote out this contract with God, and they committed their lives to God as a couple. They never owned a home after that. They never owned cars. Everything they had was provided. Just like everyone else in their ministry, they raised their own financial support. It wasn't like they were drawing a regular salary from a big company. That same year, they launched Campus Crusade for Christ at the UCLA campus. They recognized the critical role that college students had played in the great spiritual awakenings of the past. So you think about the great awakenings in the U.S. in the past. There was the first and second great awakenings, and these part of these awakenings was what was called the student volunteer movement, where college students were captured by the gospel, and they went out and started sharing their faith and started being involved. But since the two great awakenings, which would be Charles Finney and George Whitfield and Dwight Moody and these kinds of guys, Horatio P. Spafford came out of that, It Is Well With My Soul. What was the next great awakening? The next great outpouring of the Holy Spirit? The Jesus movement. We've kind of pushed it aside. It's just a bunch of hippies and, oh my goodness, that Lonnie Frisbee, I wouldn't want him hanging out with my kids, blah, blah, blah. And yet, the single greatest outpouring of the Holy Spirit in the 20th century, a bunch of hippies from California, that God captured their heart and they did amazing things. And that was the kind of people that Bill and Von Ant were working with. That was the kind of people they were trying to attract. In the late 1950s, Bill authored a small little booklet called The Four Spiritual Laws, a brief, easily shared gospel tract that would become the backbone of their growing ministry. How many people have seen a copy of the Four Spiritual Laws? You can find these online. My wife has a stack of them. She'll be happy to give one to you. Their basic strategy was and remains to win people to Christ, build them up in their faith, and send them out to do the same with others. Win, build, send. If you're around anyone involved with Campus Crusade, it comes out of their pores. Win, build, send. By 2006, this little booklet had been translated into over 200 languages, and more than 2.5 billion copies had been distributed worldwide. And this is a 20-year-old statistic. In 1958, CREW, as it's known now, expanded overseas. They held a big rally in Seoul, South Korea, that at the time was the largest Christian gathering in history. They're Koreans. They go big or go home. They don't know how to do things small. The meeting was the beginning of a world focus that would eventually lead to establishing ministries in more than 190 countries around the world. In June of 1972, in association with the Jesus Movement, CREW sponsored Expo 72 in Dallas. This was a series of evangelistic and discipleship meetings that took place in the Cotton Bowl over a series of, I think it was 5 nights. Featured speakers included Billy Graham. It also featured a Christian music festival that many people credit with the beginnings of the Christian music industry and has been dubbed by many historians as Christian Woodstock. Yes, it's cool. They weren't doing anything bad. They were doing Jesus stuff. Over 80,000 young people converged on the Cotton Bowl for this time of evangelism and training in Christian discipleship. So that was their modus operandi. They weren't satisfied with just sharing the gospel and letting people go. They wanted to share the gospel and then train you so that you could go and do that with others. And that remains their focus today. In 1979, CREW sponsored the production of the Jesus film. How many people have heard of or seen the Jesus film? 2-hour documentary on the life of Christ from the Gospel of Luke has been translated into nearly 2,000 languages and has been viewed over 8 billion times, making it the most translated and the most viewed film in history. Over 500 million people have indicated a decision for Christ after viewing this film. Today, under Bill Bright's leadership, CREW has spawned individual ministries touching every area of life. Campus ministry is how it all started, and that continues. There are over 6,000 campus ministries around the world on college campuses. There's a high school ministry. That's what my wife started out in when she was on staff with CREW. That the same thing. They're working with high school students to share the gospel with them, to win them to Christ, to build them up in their faith, and help them to do the same with others. And their parents are also strongly involved in this. There's a ministry called Family Life, has been headquartered in Little Rock, Arkansas. Now they're moving their headquarters to Orlando. We hear them on the radio all the time. K-Love has regular features from Family Life on their daily broadcast. And the goal of Family Life has been to build families in Christ, to help families to be stronger, because a house built on a what? On a rock is stronger, and Jesus is our rock. That's not their stuff, I just said that. Athletics. Campus Crusade has had a strong athletics ministry since early on. Athletes in Action. Anyone ever heard of Athletes in Action? So Athletes in Action is a sports ministry of Campus Crusade. They have sports teams in a number of sports, from baseball, basketball, volleyball, that compete during non-eligible times against NCAA teams around the world, and sometimes during Olympic competition, not at the Olympics, but in among those guys. In Fairbanks, there's a ball club called the Fairbanks Gold Panthers, and their big thing every year is they have the Midnight Sun Game. So it happens on July 4th, and there's enough daylight in Fairbanks, typically in July 4th, that they can play a night game without lights on in the stadium. And when we were there, they played the 100th Midnight Sun Game. People from Cooperstown were there. The game was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. The pitcher that was pitching there actually had some pitching records he had set with that organization and at that level of baseball. So I actually know a guy who's enshrined at Cooperstown. And Athletes in Action plays the Gold Panthers in Fairbanks regularly. They also provide pastoral and chaplain and spiritual support for college teams. And so they'll have guys on college campuses. So when Marcia and I were at University of Oregon, we knew the AIA staff guy, Dusty Davis, who was working with the University of Oregon Ducks at the time. There's still guys there. Most NCAA teams have got an Athletes in Action staff person. Athletes in Action has guys that work with amateur athletics at every level, including the Olympics, and they have guys that work with professional athletes. This is an amazing ministry that helps these guys who have these platforms to be able to conduct their lives in such a way that you'd want their kids to be like them, and then they have a platform from which to speak Christ. Because how many times have you been really enamored with an athlete, and then he wins the Super Bowl, and you're like, ew! I'm not going to name any names, but some of you know what I'm talking about. The military ministry. How many of you know that my son's in the National Guard? Still getting used to that. So he's going to Army basic training in Fort Sill in August. I really don't know what the Department of Defense has against him, but he's going to Fort Sill in August. I grew up in Oklahoma. I've been to Fort Sill in August. It's not on my list of favorite places to be. And we reached out to the crew ministry director at Fort Sill. And so he's going to be making contact with him. And during his 5 minutes of free time he has every week, he's going to try and do some stuff with the crew ministry at Fort Sill. Campus Crusade has an inner city ministry. They have a ministry that reaches out to embassy staff members, embassy delegates. They have ministries that reach out to college professors. They've recently gotten involved in doing disaster relief ministry, which is something they kind of stayed out of for years. So they have ministries involved in every area of life, all hearkening back to Bill Bright's leadership and his entrepreneurial spirit. The fact that he gathered this group of people and said, go make something happen. Crew has ministries in over 190 countries. Oh, and then the other ministry that I forgot about that I'm not sure if it exists anymore, but it did for a long time, and I've talked about this before. How many people have heard me mention the name Andre Cole? So Andre Cole, if you know anyone in the magical community, he's someone who's spoken of in hushed and reverent terms in the magical community. He was the guy that taught David Copperfield how to pull rabbits out of hats. He was with Bill Bright at Expo 72 in Dallas, And Andre Cole literally spent decades traveling the world. He's the Campus Crusade staff member that has traveled to the most countries in the world, using magic and illusion as a vehicle to share the gospel. And to counter these silly claims that people make about having supernatural powers and all this other kind of stuff. And he would literally go into, you know, a lot of that started when he would go into third world countries and people wouldn't want to come see his show because they assumed that he had some kind of dark magical powers. And so he would bring people out and he would do some simple tricks and show them how the tricks worked, which magicians don't do. And then he would invite the local witch doctor or juju man to come out and do one of his tricks. Then he would show them how the trick worked. And so all of a sudden, he's demythologizing all these people that have claims of magical abilities. And even to the extent that there was a witch doctor in Haiti who claimed to have powers given him directly by Satan himself, and Andre challenged him to a magical showdown, and he refused to accept the invitation. So Andre says, yes, Satan is real, but he's a liar and a cheater, and he has no real power in this world. But there is a God who does, and that's who I want to tell you about. So Crew has over his ministries in over 190 countries with more than 25,000 full-time staff and around 100,000 trained volunteers around the world. My wife is in the second category these days of trained volunteers. Current statistics indicate that around 300,000 in-person individual gospel presentations and around 45 million group and media gospel presentations take place each month. Let me say that again. Each month, 300,000 people have the gospel presented to them personally, and each month, 45 million people are pulling up a website or are attending a group evangelistic meeting through Campus Crusade. Literally billions of people have heard the gospel as a result of the legacy of Bill Bright. In 1996, Bill Bright was awarded the Templeton Prize for Progress in Religion. This is an award that's not as well known as the Nobel Prize, but in some ways is more prestigious. The prize that goes with it is valued at around $1.1 million, which he promptly donated to Campus Crusade to fund efforts to build prayer and fasting ministries. When this happened, Marsh and I were on staff with Crew in Orlando. And this was before 9/11, so we went to the airport, and we had a small group of us that met him at the gate with signs and yay, Dr. Bright, and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, Dr. Bright was always very humble and very self-effacing, and his comments in situations like this were always in the vein of, he's always amazed at what God can do with a simple barefoot red dirt country boy from Oklahoma. And as a barefoot red dirt country boy from Oklahoma, I always shared some kinship with that. So I briefly mentioned how these two great men were connected. Billy Graham was at Expo 72, but in truth, they were beloved friends and colleagues throughout their years in ministry. And together, the two of them literally changed the world. Go ahead, Bree. So what was the thread that connected these two? Well, now I'm going to talk about someone I almost guarantee you've never heard of. Henrietta Mears was born in Fargo, North Dakota on October 23rd, 1890. Yeah, you betcha, Fargo, North Dakota. And she was raised in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Minnesota. And her father was a successful banker, and her mother was a locally well-known Bible teacher with a spiritual heritage that extended back at least four generations. Life in the Mears home included daily family Bible study, family prayer, and hymn singing. This birthed in her a deep love for Scripture. When she was 12, she was struck with a disease at a time they called muscular rheumatism. Today we call it polymyalgia rheumatica. It's a debilitating disorder that causes severe muscle pain and disability. Through prayers of family and friends, she was miraculously healed 2 years later. Around the same time, she began to have problems with her eyesight, which would plague her for the rest of her life. She called it her greatest spiritual asset, as it forced her to depend on God. She professed a call to Christian vocational Christian service in high school and taught Bible studies through her local church. She went on to study chemistry at the University of Minnesota. In 1926, she met the pastor of First Presbyterian Church of Hollywood, California. He was so impressed with her ability to teach the Bible that he offered her the job as director of Christian education. She took the post starting in 1928 and held that position for 35 years. In that role, she encountered and influenced many future evangelical leaders, including Bill Bright and Billy Graham. Both of these men credited Ms. Mears, she never married, with playing a major role in igniting the fire in their hearts that led to the great work God had for them. As such, Ms. Mears is often referred to as the mother of modern evangelism. And none of you guys have ever heard of her. The only reason I've heard of her is because we were on staff with Campus Crusade, and everyone knows Henrietta Mears. Billy Graham declared that no woman outside his wife and mother had more influence on his life than Mears. Bill Bright described her as one of the greatest women of the 20th century and one of the greatest influences on his life. Among her many accomplishments, Ms. Mears authored several books on Bible study, including a comprehensive commentary entitled What the Bible is All About, which includes summaries and study helps of all 66 books of the Bible. You can buy this today. It's still in print. It'll cost you less than $20. I would encourage you to go get it. In truth, it would be difficult to imagine three more ordinary people: a cattle rancher from Oklahoma, a dairy farmer from North Carolina, and a teacher from North Dakota. What Mears imparted to Bill Bright and Billy Graham was a deep and abiding love of his word and a passion for sharing it with others. These are men who left their mark on the world today because of this unwavering calling born out of their deep love. How about us? We're no less ordinary than them. Some of us are more ordinary than that. That's hard to imagine, but I am. So what are we doing to build in us a deep and abiding love of God and his word? And more importantly, what are we doing to build this in those around us? Well, there's lots of things that we can do. We have a men's retreat coming up, May 2 through 4. Isn't that cool? Susan did that. May 2 through 4, the men of grace are going back to Cathedral Pines Baptist Camp up north of Haley. And our theme this year is going to be Men of Grace, Know Their God and Act Valiantly. And our speaker is going to be helping us to know our God better by leading us in a study of the names of God. The goal is to challenge each other to act valiantly as we know our God better. Initially, this sermon was going to be next week, so we're still working on getting the sign-up ready, but be watching this week. Sign-ups will go live. You don't want to miss this, men. Wives, send your husbands. Other things that we can do to be involved in helping people to know their God. We have an amazing Awana ministry in this church. Of course, Awana is an amazing ministry all by itself, but the one that's run here is particularly amazing. We have kids that are by the time a kid graduates from the Awana program, they have literally memorized thousands of Bible verses. Not tens, not hundreds, thousands of Bible verses. And kids from the Awana program have gone on to become leaders in the youth ministry, and at least one kid from the Awana program is now teaching a class in the Awana program. I'm not going to say anything, but she might be related to me. The Movement Youth. Javi and Davina are doing an amazing job leading our youth to know their God and to act valiantly. Here's the thing. We've got kids from Awana that have moved into the youth group, and these are sharp kids coming out of the Awana program, right, Javi? Javi agrees with that, if you didn't see the glare moving back and forth. But not only that, how many people notice that we've got kids from the youth group in our worship team now? So kids from the youth group are now taking leadership in the church, which is what youth groups are supposed to be. So they're doing something right. We have a college and career study being led by Matt and Nicole Tarbox. I called Matt and asked him, what are you guys doing? Oh, you know, we're studying the book of Romans. I didn't study Romans when I was in a college and career Bible study. So these guys are rolling up their pant legs and getting into some deep water. And that's cool. They're planning on doing some stuff for girls and some stuff for men and some stuff for women. After they finish Romans, the women are going to be studying the book of Esther. The men are still deciding what they're going to do, but they're also going to do some man stuff, of course. And then adult Bible studies. We're in the very beginning stages of planning, so we don't have anything specific to talk about, but we have an exciting new adult Bible study launch for this fall. Our goal is to have trained adults leading groups to help people know their God better so that they too can act valiantly. So stay tuned for more. So what can you do? You can volunteer in the Awana program. I guarantee you, if you talk to Courtney or Jake, they will put you to work. You can volunteer in the youth. I guarantee you, Javi and Davina can find something for you to do. You can start a Bible study of your own, or you can join a new one. If you don't think you know what to do, talk to me, talk to Travis. We can point you in a direction. You can become trained and lead one of the new Bible studies at Grace. There'll be more coming out about that. You can attend the men's retreat, or women, you can send your husbands. The point is, be intentional about building yourself and others in the Word so that you and those around you can know your God and when called upon to act valiantly. And I just realized I didn't tell Matt when we were going to end this. So Matt is valiantly coming up onto the stage.
That's it for today's teaching. Hey, here's an idea. Share today's message with a friend or family member. If you're listening from outside our fellowship, we'd love to meet you. Visit graceid.org and hit the contact form to get in touch. We'd also love for you to join us. You can even check us out on Facebook Live by searching Facebook for Grace Church Rupert ID. Learn more and plug in at graceid.org. Thanks for listening to this week's message from Grace Community Church.